listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to History and You with George Rodriguez Walling right here on LA Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show, History and You, the show where history matters because it's all about you in the here and the now. I'm your host, George Rodriguez Walling, and we're all very excited here to bring you our first show on the air to share all the triumphs, all the struggles, the discomforts in our attempts to be more than what we are. If you want to call in and contribute your issues, insights, convictions, opinions, agreements and disagreements, experiences, whatever it be, please call at 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. If, on the other hand, you're shy about going on the air but want to contribute something that just can't wait, well, you can send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. This information you will also find on the website. Okay, on this show, we talk about a series of contemporary issues, common issues, current issues that people have to face every single day, and from which many of these are stemmed neck deep in history. All controversial, all uncomfortable, and they all continue to affect our lives in one way or another to some degree. But it's how we decide to deal with them that identify and validate our character. How we get past the issues that diminish us can either enhance our strength, make us better, make us stronger, or sell us out as a person. After many of us go through so much soul-searching in our lives, therapy for many, seminars and workshops for others, or just a single and simple moment of reflection, one has to wonder, what is it about the history of us, about who and what we are, that continues to confine us for centuries, to repeat the same condescending patterns of imposing onto others our viewpoints, our class customs, our fashions and behaviors, and our civilizational way of thinking, which have only served to create attitudes for more conflict and more wars? Are we, as a people, naturally conflicted? Well, I'll tell you, thank goodness our natures are also capable of replicating a positive and productive side, such as making a happy difference for many others, like the sick and the old and the young. But our mindsets, and how we each view one another and view the world are like traps that sometimes just keep us jailed in to repeat the many mistakes of the past. And at this point, let me remind our audience, for the participants who wish to call in and comment, the number is 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. We'd love to hear from you, or just send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. Okay? Now, occasionally, and this is only once in a while, but occasionally, someone comes along with a sense of leadership that can influence, even change those roped-in, stodgy attitudes that make a better difference for all of us. We've all known about these people in the past, from the days of Moses and Jesus to insightful leaders of Europe and the Far East, even Reagan, and perhaps others, if you wish it so. But my list is short. These people have inspired us always to do better, to do more with what we have, to become more humane. And we evolve. We move forward. We do. We continue to develop and evolve, but with an unexplainable tilt that drives us to meander once too often.
Why?
So tonight, let's consider the example and the influence, in short, the leadership of one of these men, Abraham Lincoln, from the new Steven Spielberg movie simply entitled Lincoln, starring Daniel Day-Lewis and Sally Fields. My guest this evening, who is here to share his observations of the movie and comment on the leadership style of Mr. Lincoln himself under some of the most adversarial conditions imaginable, is Mr. Patrick Griffin, a teacher and educator of the finest caliber, a history buff, and even a rock and roll buff himself. Welcome to the show, Pat.
Pleased to be here.
Pat, I saw the movie on Sunday. It was riveting. It was gripping. It was really excellent, an excellent piece of art. But I have to ask you, I'm just curious. Is there a Marxist message in the movie based on what class warfare?
Well, certainly there is an element of class warfare involved, but I don't know that I would go so far personally as to classify it as Marxist. To my view, what was going on in the film was they actually sort of de-emphasized the economic aspect of the states' rights conflict and the Civil War more to the human rights aspect. And, of course, Marxism is focused heavily on economic matters.
Well, but I mean, the idea that class warfare has always existed, and knowing that the Old South was, for all intents and purposes, a feudal society from the beginning of the 19th century all the way up until the end of the war. Mm-hmm. So there is a sense of class struggle there. And the movie did, without making any bones about it, that it emphasized very much the freeing of a people that were literally enslaved.
Absolutely.
So from that perspective, you would have to agree that there was this disturbing warfare, and so Marxist comes to mind. But was it a Marxist argument to the extent that the blacks were going to revolt and change the government, or was it an attempt to just equal out the playing field and follow the constitutional promise of equality for everyone?
Well, I think looking at the intent of the artist, and of course, whenever you examine a piece of art, the question is, do you examine the art for what it is in and of itself, or do you take into account what you know of the artist creating the art? And what I know of Spielberg has a history of dealing with human rights issues. Certainly Schindler's List is clearly a human rights-centered film. Amistad is dealing with these exact same human rights in a different time period. And I think really that element of class warfare may be there, but for Spielberg personally, it's more of a human rights thing. It's a right and wrong social justice thing for him more than it is an economic justice.
Well, okay, but then at this point, I would have to ask the question then, at what point do you begin to draw the line there? Because how can you distinguish in the mind of the public what is a human rights issue and what is a Marxist argument that attempts to move forward to change, to overthrow something, an established order, and supplant it for something else.
Well, and again, I'm not really seeing the Marxist angle in the film. And one of the things that would lead me to believe that is if you speak specifically of overthrow, the Lincoln film is very celebratory of the United States. It is congratulatory that we got past ills. And in that sense, it's not so much rebellion as it is backslapping that we're past a certain thing.
What do you mean by ills in particular?
I think it clearly depicts the folks who are anti-abolition as villains. You can see that in the lighting of the film, in the fact that they often portrayed them as sweating more heavily than the abolitionists. You can see the intent of Spielberg, the artist, there. Whether the script follows through that, the historical record or not, he is painting much more of a pro-America picture, I think, than necessarily saying that it needs to change towards a future sociological objective.
Pat, is there a class warfare in the United States today?
Oh, absolutely, to some degree. Some in some areas more than others.
And because what I'd like to see if I can do is jump forward and begin to compare it to our first African American president. Mm-hmm. To what degree do you think that President Obama has been responsible in creating a scenario of class warfare?
Well, certainly it's to his political advantage to play up the income inequality issue. That plays to his political base, and it is something that polls strongly in his favor. So in the sense of it being an election year issue that he emphasized for political gain, that's clearly the case. If that is the only issue that motivated that, that would be more than a little crass. I'm not sure that that's his only motivation, though, in doing so.
No, because I'm struck with the idea of how a black man's performance is being seen after Lincoln did what he did in freeing the slaves. But as a black man's performance, don't you think that he has served to distinctly differentiate between the abuse of the rich class or the wealthier class people, hence the reason for all his taxing measures now and mm-hmm. in trying to save the middle class, but the middle class is also equally strapped with a whole bunch of other regulatory measures coming down from the federal government?
Well, I'm not sure I perceive. What's the question there?
Well, what I'm asking you, Pat, is don't you think that Obama is trying to establish more class warfare by separating interests as well as other issues between the wealthier classes and the middle class, but he's really not he's trying to demonize the wealthy people, don't you think? Go ahead.
One thing about that, first of all, I think that there is more to it than just an animosity for the wealthy. I think part of it is an economic judgment that falls in line with the economic advisors that he has had, that a stronger middle class is ultimately what's needed for the economy. It's consumer-driven rather than supplier-driven. It's an economic perspective that requires higher wages, that requires job stability, and these sorts of things. So, I mean, it is clearly politically advantageous to play up the social element of, I've heard it described, soak the rich. But it's also part of his economic philosophy and mainstream democratic social philosophy, economic philosophy, that there needs to be a consumer base, not simply a supplier base.
Well, we're talking about leadership here. We're talking about presidential leadership, and as presidential leadership, one would come to expect that he tries to achieve a sense of consensus. Mm-hmm. In Lincoln's time, achieving consensus among Republicans to mm-hmm. try and moderate their attitudes, that of the role brilliantly played by Tommy Lee Jones for Thaddeus Stevens, trying to temper the excess of zeal on the part of the mm-hmm. radical Republicans. In bringing it more into the mainstream, as Obama should try to create a sense of consensus among the different classes, among the corporate leaders and the working class, the middle class folks that are needing to do all sorts of things now to deal with the new regulations coming down from the Obama administration. So is the presidential leadership from President Obama, one that one can say, wow, it's really beginning to make a positive difference in my life?
Well, I mean, everyone's individual experiences are going to vary, and everyone's perceptions of their individual experiences may be at odds with the reality. Of course, no one sees themselves perfectly clearly, and so there may be a perception gap. There's some cognitive dissonance in everyone's life. But beyond the perception of how it's affected the individual life within a four-year span, presidents tend to be judged in legacies that are much more long-term than their own presidency. Bill Clinton's legacy is coming more into focus now than it was when he left office, as is often the case with presidents. Ronald Reagan's place in history was not cemented entirely until much after his presidency had ended. But in terms of does leadership require consensus building, I would submit that Lincoln said no. Lincoln ultimately used his power rather broadly to enforce his will, because in his view, the Union long-term required
that. And you don't think Obama has done that?
I think to some extent he has attempted to do that. I think the Affordable Care Act is an example of him using his political capital, spending all of it clearly in 2008 and 2009, which cost him in 2010 midterm election. Mm. And to that extent, he is using the power that he has, whether that's an agreeable policy or not. Clearly, that is leadership. It might not be leadership that we necessarily individually agree with. It might be. But there is something to be said for the general will concept of pushing the view forward and the people will.
Well, but leadership cannot come to a point where one can say, well, you know, it could be this, it could be perceived as that.
Sure.
Leadership has to have a certain quality of universality behind it. And I think that people come to recognize that. Reagan was clearly provided a kind of leadership that people identified with, mm-hmm. because of his level of charisma, his degree of insight,
sure.
His ability to be persuasive, his ability to get things done and undone, just the same way as Lincoln mm-hmm. Had his qualities. The leadership of Obama seems to be taking more of a separatist point of view than anything else. The way I view his leadership among not only his cabinet, but among the American people. Remember, Obama won the election without necessarily having an officially established mandate. And we're talking about a mandate here. We're not talking about anything less than that. The will of the majority of the people simply did not want him there. And yet he wins by an edge based on the Electoral College returns. But if you look at the states, the mandate was clearly absent.
Well, George, there I'm going to respectfully disagree. President Obama won a majority of the popular vote twice. He won electoral landslides twice. Now, of course, he didn't win all of the states, and he didn't win all of the states that are traditionally Republican. Republicans typically pick up many of the smaller states, but there is no precedent in American history for saying you need a plurality of states unless, of course, it's a tiebreaker in the House of Representatives.
Then, Pat, how can you explain that there are just so many people out there that really wanted to see a change in the White House, like Romney there?
We have a very divided electorate. There were just as many who were passionate that they did want.
Doesn't that in and of itself show you that the lack of having a mandate speaks loud enough to let people know that, you know, this African-American president, as well qualified that some people may perceive him to be, yet lacks the leadership qualities needed to make a difference in people in modern society?
Well, I would say that it depends on how you define those statements. And again, I'm not sure that in a divided electorate you can have a mandate that is all people agree. All people agree has never happened in American politics, never once. Mm-hmm. Reagan didn't have 100%. George Washington did, but that was because he didn't have a record. And people perceived when they were running for president, of course, the original system, they were trying to finish second so as to be his vice president.
Coming on the heels of the Lincoln film, which just came mm-hmm. out, which I want to take a moment to talk about. But on the heels of that, how would you rate the Obama leadership, not the administration, but the leadership that he has provided in the past 4 years, connected to the idea that of a leadership that came from a man like Lincoln that provided so many great examples for so many people looking back in hindsight?
Well, I think it depends on how you're defining the term leadership. If you say as a consensus builder, he was as good a consensus builder as Lincoln in his own time, because Lincoln barely won re-election. He actually had a much closer election than Obama did. At the time, he had enemies that were very strongly against him in his own party, and the ones that were against him beyond his own party were shooting guns at him.
Well, doesn't that description so far carry a sense of universality? Doesn't it go against the idea that you just mentioned that, well, it does require, it depends on how you define it. You know,
sure.
It's not necessarily how you define it, but there is there are some general components that the majority of people must agree to that makes up good leadership. And has it all been there for Obama?
Well, it seems to me that you keep coming back to the idea that there can't be strong opposition if someone is to be defined as a leader. And if that be the case, there are very few presidents that we would consider to be the great presidents or the notable presidents that would fit the definition.
Hmm.
Reagan would not fit that definition. Franklin Roosevelt would not fit that definition. Teddy Roosevelt would not fit that definition. The only one who is on the short list of most people's minds as a great president would be Washington, but that's because there was great opposition one step below him. Then you had the Adams versus Jefferson debate. It was just as divided, but Washington was seen as above it.
Tell me, Pat, how have blacks used their freedom since the days of Lincoln?
Well, I think it's always dangerous territory to classify an entire population as having a single report card, if you will, a single set of aims, a single set of actions that are attributable to all of them. I think there are people who have distinguished themselves very admirably and others who have not.
Yeah. I was struck at a moment in the film when it was talking about the 13th Amendment and how Lincoln and others in his cabinet, Seward as well, fought so hard to get that amendment passed. And we all know how politics just envelops everyone in the process of wanting to do or not do certain things.
Absolutely.
But I'm wondering, was it more of a power grab for just to get the 13th Amendment passed and just to let the remaining Southern Democrats that were left in that Congress to just cave into the enormous Republican Party presence that was there at that time? Was it a power grab or was it real interest for the blacks?
Well, I think it was both. I think the Republican Party was well aware that they had a limited window in which they could pass basically anything that they wanted short of that, and that was going to be a stretch because it was a reach. Because they had trouble holding their own party together, but at the time that they were running this legislation out, they had the southern states were in open rebellion, and the Democrats that were left in Congress by and large were moderate Democrats relative to their era, and all they had to do was hold together their own base, and they could pass virtually anything. Mm-hmm. So they were rather aggressive in some of the things that they passed. And you see some of that in the Andrew Johnson administration just after Lincoln, in which they offered legislation, and when he vetoed it, they went back with the 14th and 15th Amendments.
Well, you know, I'm going to respectfully disagree with you, because I'm going to say that I think it was more of an interest, or rather, I think it was more of a power grab than genuine interest for blacks, because I think that blacks, to a large degree, were used as tokens, just so that they can find an opportunity or an open window to overpower the southern white Democrats that still existed in the South. The radical Republicans under Charles Sumner and Thaddeus Stevens were just looking for opportunities to try and really needle at the Southern whites and make their existence as a reminder that they were the ones that started the war as miserable as possible. And what better way than to use blacks to get at the Southern whites?
Sure.
And so if it was a power grab, which I think a lot of the film really shows the politics involved,
yes,
the pull and the tug and the negotiations and the need to be persuasive and the need to be things that normally you are not,
Absolutely. It's very good at showing the process.
Very much so. And it was a situation that leaves one thinking, well, you know, this is for the interest of blacks. Are we doing this in the interest of blacks, or are we doing this just for the sake of, you know, gaining a position of advantage or gaining some kind of a political edge? And mm-hmm. and I think it was more the political edge and the advantage than genuine interest for blacks. I really don't think that at that time, very, very, very few people genuinely cared for blacks.
Right, and that's true. The prejudice was very deep, and what would be considered to be very liberal or expansive in that time would be considered reprehensibly backward thinking to us. Some of the things that Lincoln privately said were things that would be extremely un-PC now.
Yeah.
And I think the Thaddeus Stevenses of the world, who were very extreme in their methods and very extreme in their language at times, even they would be not as – they would not line up with the middle of our country now and on some of their views.
Well, you know, this program tonight is about leadership. We're really focusing on the leadership of Lincoln and comparing it to the leadership of Obama. What do people look for in leadership?
Well, I think it really depends on who those people are. I think what characteristics you value in a chosen leader, who you choose as a leader, who you identify as a leader, speaks to the person being led almost as much, if not more, than the leader themselves. Who you gravitate towards, who you put your trust in, is an act of choice on the part of the person being led.
You know, I'm often left wondering, does a leader provide leadership by needing to reconfigure the table that he's setting up before him? Does he need to be a divider of sorts in order to lead properly?
Well, I think, again, we need to know what leading properly means. If the objective, if the idea is to advance the greater good in the long term, to create necessary long-term change, then sometimes yes, sometimes no. Sometimes a vision is what's required. Sometimes making the sausage is what's required, as is depicted in the Lincoln film with the 13th Amendment. At times they had to subvert their true views. At times they had to buy votes. And I don't think it makes any bones about the fact that sometimes the process is not as clean as the ideals might be or certainly are presented as being.
All right. Well, very good. Let me take a quick pause to remind our audience, in case you're joining us late, for the participants who wish to call in and comment. The number here is 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. Or just send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. All of us here would really love to hear from you. Now, Pat, let me talk a little bit about the actual movie. Cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
Absolutely.
I thought that, you know, great lighting effects to set the mood of the moment. Why don't you comment a little bit? Would you elaborate for our audience a little bit as far as the quality of cinematography that went behind this Spielberg film?
Absolutely. One of the things that is notable about Spielberg generally is he tends to have a very how do I say this? He is a believer in the auteur theory of film. He's someone who believes in having distinct visual style, and he shows that through lighting, through costume, through color scheme, and through camera movement. He's someone that is known for using a lot of crane shots, a lot of aerials, but in his more serious films like this, like Schindler's List, like Amistad, he tends to be a little bit more restrained, although less so in Amistad, in all honesty. Some of those angles were rather extreme. Mm. The costumes and backdrops in this particular film are extremely accurate, and that was a choice that he made because, to some extent, Spielberg was making the history movie he wanted to make rather than trying to make a film purely for entertainment.
Yeah, well, one of the things that really struck me was the degree of realism mm-hmm. that Spielberg brings to the audience. It's almost as if the audience is transported and transcends everything at the present and becomes there.
Absolutely.
It suddenly appears there at the moment. And it's interesting also to see how this incredible degree of realism has changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you saw a film on Lincoln, say 50, 60 years ago,
right,
or in what they used to call more of the golden age of Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
You would find films of this sort with a completely different kind of realism, almost
Absolutely.
As if it's similar to the Greeks and the Romans. You know, mm-hmm. it's interesting to note that when it came to sculpture in the Romans would create sculptures with faces that had dents or blemishes or whatever, just to depict a sense of realism
yes.
of what a Roman actually looked like, from the hair to the eyes, the look and expression, the quality of skin, the texture of the skin, to try and you know, bring that across through sculpture, a tremendous artistic value behind that.
Absolutely.
And the Greeks, on the other hand, were people that tried to hide all of that realism.
Right, they
and
idealized.
Exactly,
yeah.
They idealized the physical beauty, almost a fantasy, a surreal type of moment to look at a human being in his most beautificational state.
Absolutely.
Okay? So what I want to begin to compare here is America, the filmmaking society back in those years, imitating more of the Greek model in trying to almost romanticize and patronize the beauty of our historical heroes, as opposed to being more like the Romans / Spielberg /
right.
realistic.
Right.
This is what it was really like. What's better? What's better for the audience to get here?
Well, I think when you're looking at like the Golden Age, the idealized Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, as opposed to this Lincoln film, what you get is films that have different aims for different audiences. I think the Golden Age, the Golden Age of cinema, many of the producers of the major studios were recent immigrants themselves, and they were very sensitive of projecting themselves as very patriotic. They were wanting to serve the aims of the nation and be identified as true Americans. And there was a great impulse to be entirely celebratory about the United States and everything that it stands for. Part of that, too, is that even in the 1940s, there was enough of an underpinning to know that the Red Scare was coming, and, of course, McCarthyism and the blacklist in cinema.
Right.
So there was a practical reason to have that perspective. But there was that hero worship, that hagiography of American history.
Right. Right.
And then now we have more of a yen towards realism. You can see that in all sorts of film, from the Christopher Reeve Superman to the modern superhero films, where they dumb down the costumes to make them more less ridiculous.
Exactly. And you know, it's funny you should bring that up, because the idea of Superman came up just to try and revitalize the sense of national patriotism for the
Absolutely.
Americans during World War II. So at this point, let me ask you, what is better for the public to get? Is it that sense of romanticism, that sense of patriotism in movies, or that sense of raw realism that hits people like a brick and really lets them know this is what it was really like?
Well, to my mind, certainly in certain eras, you'll need different things. But one of the things that shows growth in the nation as a whole is that we are capable of both, that there is a place for both. If I were showing a film to my younger siblings or children, I would start with the idealistic and discuss from there. And when they're ready, go a little bit more complex, more shades of gray. If I'm sitting with my colleagues, I would prefer something that is more layered.
Yeah.
And there's a place for both. And one of the glories of America is we can have both.
You know that Lincoln was a manic depressant.
Absolutely.
And as a manic depressant, he had all sorts of peaks and valleys. And his wife, Mary, unfortunately, after the president expired from an assassin's bullet, as we know, John Wilkes Booth, she underwent all sorts of different changes in her lifestyle until she ended up being committed to an insane asylum.
Right.
But the costumes in the set in relation to the realism and his manic depressant state, in addition to having to deal with the Civil War, really brings in some very, very remarkably dark moments in the movie.
It's not a happy film.
No, no. And you see that. You see that, and it lays an impact on you. Pat, let me go back to President Obama, because I really find it interesting the fact that Lincoln, the movie comes out, he frees the slaves once again, and at the same time, we have our president, our first African-American president, and his quality of leadership as well. It's almost like, how has Obama proven his leadership to a man that basically set him free?
Right, and whom he clearly idolizes. Yeah.
How would you compare the scenarios? Lincoln from 1861 to 1865 to Obama 2008 to 2012.
Well, in some ways, clearly, no one in presidential history has been under more pressure than Abraham Lincoln. He had a civil war. He had the largest death toll of any American war. And civil wars are historically throughout any civilization especially brutal, especially volatile. They could go any which way and reshape the country no matter what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And President Obama was dealing with a very divided electorate and a very significant economic challenge and two wars, but not wars that we were in any danger of physically losing. We were not going to be conquered by anyone that was in those wars. And the economic crisis, while severe, was not going to permanently collapse the economy. We were not in an existential crisis.
Well, if I were to say that Lincoln emphasized law, democracy, and order, what would you say Lincoln emphasized the most?
Of those three, order. I think
because of the Civil War.
Civil War, and I think he took his war powers very seriously. He was a very skilled lawyer, so he was aware he was occasionally stepping over a line.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote as much. I think I may be over a line here.
Now, with Obama, if I were to say that he emphasized spending and taxing, class warfare, and creeping socialism as an extension of the federal government, expanding its regulatory powers to regulate smaller business and people, which of these three would you say President Obama has emphasized the most?
Well, I think he would disagree with the word choice for one thing, but of course of those, I would think Obama would emphasize. Let's see, taxing and spending.
Spending and taxing, class warfare, and creeping socialism.
Okay. Well, I would say that a lot of his spending initiatives are what he would call social justice, which could also be classified as class warfare, depending on how one felt about the changes he was trying to make. What he would call social justice would be the part of the motivation for the taxing and spending. He would also see the taxing and spending as necessary and helpful for the economy.
During a moment of recession?
I think he feels that the changes that he's making are helpful for the recession. I think, for example, TARP, which was begun under the Bush administration.
But, you know, normally in a moment of recession, you just don't tax.
I don't know that that's actually true.
What do you base that on?
Well, for one thing, during the Great Depression, we had a maximum tax rate of over 90%. Now the maximum tax rate, the debate is, should we move it from 35 to 39 as opposed to 91?
Mm-hmm.
So to say that we just gash taxes completely during recession is untrue.
Mm. So out of these three, then the one that you think President Obama emphasizes the most would be creeping socialism, right?
Well, you could say if you classify creeping socialism as increased regulation, then increased regulation is certainly part of it.
A socialistic characteristic would be a political system whose central or federal government arrangement has expanded to such an extent that it provides an elaborate amount of entitlement programs, mm-hmm. having to be responsible for pensions, having to be responsible for financially keeping those pensions afloat, and of course, an extension of federal government regulation that begins to choke off a certain degree of independence on the part of people and what they want to do in their small businesses.
Well, if you refer to like business regulations and the social safety net as having those effects, then you could say that certainly those are objectives of the Obama administration. And if you presuppose that's the effect they have, then the characterization is accurate.
Okay, very good. Well, we've reached a part of our show where I would like to leave our listeners then with a final thought to consider, a final thought to contemplate, to reflect on, and to try and think about the quality of our leadership, what we had, what we hope to continue to have, which is good leader in and of itself, to assist and to guide the population toward a better place. And so I want to leave you with this final thought. Leadership is driven by how much you care for others, because it is precisely in those others that allow you to find in them the inspiration to lead. An elected responsibility presupposes, and perhaps even requires, an advanced insight as to how to lead our human natures to a better place with each other. Now, once in a while, we've had such persons pay us a visit, but we've hardly recognized them, let alone pay them tribute to what they've done to further shape our democracy. And it's always amazing to me to see how much we've learned from Lincoln well after his time, even to see how he is presently revered as one of our very best presidents, when at the time he was considered most troublesome and quite controversial. And why? Because of his ability to think outside the laws in order to save the law, to save the union, and to spare our democracy. It seems to me that we punish those kinds of leaders in the harshest of ways for choices made in policies questioned that we do not fully understand, and we feel righteous about what we do. But then after a while, we revert back to doubting our institutions and our democracy once again without giving it much thought. But until such extraordinary people come along, it must become our private responsibility to remain legitimate, to remain institutional, to remain orderly in how we live our lives. The choice is yours. It's always been yours, for you to make a better difference for yourself and for others in our democracy. So be tolerant, be patient, and above all, be moral. I want to thank my guest tonight, Mr. Pat Griffin, for coming down and sharing this hour with us. Thank you, Pat, very much.
You're more than welcome.
If you want to get a message off to Mr. Griffin, please drop me an email and it'll be forwarded to him. And don't forget to catch our show next Tuesday night at 7 p.m. by visiting our website at latalkradio.com and look for History and You. Thank you and good evening.
Listening to History and You with George Rodriguez Wally right here on LA Talk Radio.